Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, music and poetry, and a lot of great conversation as we celebrate just a little bit early St. Patrick's Day. The man who Scott Simon said is the most eloquent man in the world, Frank Delaney, will be with us again this hour. He was with us 1 year ago, and we are going to talk about his homeland, my homeland as well, during this hour for an early St. Patrick's Day celebration.
I've walked the hills when rain was falling, rested by a white oak tree, heard a lark sing high at evening, caught a moonbeam on the sea. Softly blow, ye winds of morning, sing ye winds your mournful sound. Blow ye from the earth's four corners, guide the traveler where he's bound.
Frank Delaney is our guest this hour. Frank is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Ireland, and he has written many other novels of Ireland. One has recently been released, The Last Storyteller, and they address decade by decade the 20th century history of homeland. Frank is just an amazing guy. He's a broadcaster on radio and television. He's a screenwriter, lecturer, playwright, and scholar. Documentary subjects include Joyce and Shaw, Oscar Wilde, Emily Dickinson. He also is doing this remarkable project for all of you fans of Ulysses. And I know there are some in the audience who've read the whole book. He is doing a reconstruction, deconstruction, looking at James Joyce, Ulysses, line by line. He has five-minute broadcasts that he does once a week. Don't you love this? And they're posted on his website. And this project is going to go on for a long period of time. He also, on his blog, writes pieces about what he's writing and what he's reading, and he challenges people who are part of the website to come up with creative ideas themselves. And we're just delighted to have Frank with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
So
has it really been a year?
Yes, it has. It goes so fast, doesn't
it? Remember that old joke, we can't go on meeting like this, people will begin to talk?
I know. Well, I'm introducing you at the end of the show. I'm going to say same time next year.
Absolutely.
Mr. Delaney.
Yes. There's a movie in that somewhere.
Yes, there is. Yeah. So you've done another book. Tell me about this whole project of looking decade by decade at the history of the 20th century in Ireland. This is a massive project, really, isn't it?
Several years ago, I wrote this novel called Ireland, which was a huge success, to my astonishment. And I wrote it for two reasons. One, the minor reason was James Michener had never been to Ireland and consequently had never written a novel called Ireland, as he did Hawaii and Texas and all the others. But secondly, because I realized that I wanted to know as much as I could find out about my own country and why it has this outsize universal personality. St. Patrick's Day is the only national day of any country in the world that is celebrated everywhere.
Mm.
So what was it about this extraordinary rock up in the northwest Atlantic, what the French called the Façade Atlantique, 33,000 square miles? It would fit into many, if not most, states of the Union. What was it about this island that gave it such an enormous personality? So it's really been a process, Kathleen, of interrogation. And I thought that if I began to interrogate the century in which my parents lived most of their lives, and in the middle of which I was born, I would sort of take the part for the whole and learn more and more and more. And sure enough, these books are for me, as well as I hope for my readers, they're really for me primarily a process of learning.
Mm. And why were you surprised that Ireland took off and became such a huge bestseller, Frank?
This is what took me by surprise, and it took everybody else involved around, associated with the book by surprise. We expected, for example, that if I went out to a library or a bookshop somewhere to talk about this book, that the majority of the audience would have Irish ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
That was the case, but only by a tiny percentage, where we expected 40% other nationalities, or 30% other nationalities, and 70% Irish. It was almost exactly the other way around, because the book Ireland, as are all my subsequent books, they're kind of based on or hang from the idea of story and storytelling. And of course, every nationality in the world has always, for generations, had its own storytelling system. I mean, who are better storytellers, for example, than the Jews of Eastern Europe?
And the latest book that you've done is The Last Storyteller.
Ironic title. Because there's no such thing as the last storyteller. As long as there is breath in an Irish body, there will be a storyteller somewhere. He is meant to convey to house telling stories. But that's not the case either, because this man is not done by a long chalk with telling stories. So there was an irony there. And in actual fact, the last word of the author's note at the beginning of the book, the sort of little valediction I do at the beginning of every book, is the word irony. But there is also the sense in which I wanted to convey the actual power of your own story when you tell it to yourself. If you stand back, if you're having a tough time, and you stand back objectively, and you say to yourself, now what does this look like? What would this look like to somebody from the outside world? What am I looking like here? What is the story of what's going on? You very often get a fresh handle on it. So the point of the book, really, underneath the surface, is that the whole business of story and telling oneself one's own story can be, if you make it so or see it as so, a healing process.
And the thing about story as well, we do this with our children because it keeps us immortal in a way, doesn't it? We always tell, remember about your grandfather, remember this story, and then you tell the story again and again.
What did you do in the war, Daddy? And I personally, if I go to a gathering or a dinner or a party and there are people there who are a good deal older than I am, I try almost invariably to make a point of getting to talk to them and find out what their story is, what their lives have been like. And I have a wonderful time. Because what's more captivating than somebody telling you his or her story? You know this yourself when you sit down to talk with children. When you sit down, indeed, to talk with adults, Kathleen, if you start with the immortal words, listen, I have a great story to tell you, you have a captive audience. But also you're giving them something of yourself. The simplest thing we can give anybody of ourselves on a day-to-day basis is a story. And we do it all the time at work. It may not begin once upon a time or long, long ago when the pigs went barefoot. It may not begin like that. But nonetheless, when you come home in the evening, after work, after a day out, shopping, whatever, and you sit down to dinner with your loved ones, you are beginning to tell them the story of your day, and you're hoping they will do the same.
You did recently a Twitter contest, actually, which I thought was wonderful and might be a good thing to do tonight. You ask people to fill in once upon a time.
That's right. And you know, hundreds of people rose to that challenge. I was kind of astonished. And people are captivated by the very phrase once upon a time. And there has to be a reason why that phrase has stayed in our consciousness and our literature for such a long time. Because it is a captivating phrase. It indicates that long, long ago, something very, very interesting happened. And if you stick around, I'm going to tell you what it is. But more than that, Kathleen, the thing about a good story is, there used to be a newspaper in London that had, as its masthead slogan, all human life is there. Well, in a good story, all human life is there.
Mm.
The fairy stories are morality tales. Aesop's fables are instructional tales. Our very first form of emotional and cultural instruction was story. I say in this book, The Last Storyteller, I say, for example, that mythology was the Bible ever before there was a Bible.
You had to dive into some nasty stories concerning killing and gun running and revolution and the IRA, et cetera. And it was that hard for you to do in this particular book? You did a lot of research on it, I'm sure, but this is also a part of Ireland that troubles to the very core.
That's a very good question, because it's based on very astute reading. It was extremely difficult. It happened in my lifetime. I knew boys caught up in it. Mm. It was part of my emotional formation as a child. You know that wacky patriotism you get when you're about 14 if you're a boy and you want to carry a gun and fight your country's enemies? That was all going on in my high school at this particular time. The period of this book is around the mid-1950s, 1956, when there was a new revolution happened in Ireland. People started fighting again. And I remember so well the fear that gripped us all, that it was going to become widespread, at least the fear that gripped me as a child. And I found that when I was researching it for this book, and went into it in more detail, even more than I normally do, and I read a lot more than I was ever going to need, I found that it was extremely painful to write about, because there were people dying that we knew. There were young men of whom we knew, or relatives, or a friend of a friend, or whatever, dying in this batty, wacky, wild-eyed cause. I mean, it was, as I said at the time, it was a banana republic without the bananas. And it was terrifying, and it was extremely painful to write about. I did a gig here in New York the other night. I shared a platform with a writer whom I greatly admire, Sebastian Junger, who wrote The Perfect Storm, and wrote this amazing book called War, about his, which is the book of his film Restrepo. And we were talking about very different experiences of war reporting and writing about war. And I realized that though he was billeted with a unit of the U.S. Army on top of a bare mountain in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan in four firefights a day, his situation was no more terrifying than the intimate situation I grew up in from time to time and later reported on. That, in other words, violence of that kind, political violence, has a reality you never forget.
Mm-hmm. No, you never forget. And you never forget all that Ireland was to you, too. Can you tell me, I don't think I've ever asked you about your years in County Tipperary, your birth there, and your schooling and growing up in Ireland. And then I know you moved to England. Tell me about your early years in your homeland.
I hope this show runs until about 6 o'clock today. Because you're going to need it, Kathy. I cut straight to the shorthand, the best shorthand I can give you, which is this. I grew up in County Tipperary. My parents, I was the youngest of 8 children. My parents were the local village school teachers, and as such, pillars of the community. The parish priest, the teachers, and the doctor ran the parish. My father filled in all the forms for everybody. My mother helped deliver the children and lay out the dead. But here's the point. Directly across from our house, up the fields, about 3/4 of a mile, it was the first thing I saw every morning, and the last thing I saw every night, between us and the mountains, there was this magnificent, and I mean magnificent, old castle. It was modeled on Versailles. When my father got to the parish for the first time ever in 1913, the castle was still functioning, and there were 220 gardeners working there. That will give you an idea of the size. The local men, when the Great War started, the people went off to war and went back to England or whatever, and the local men stole in there at night time and took the lead off the roofs to sell on the black market for making bullets. The rain got in, and by the time the war was over, the inside of the castle was pretty well wrecked. So they sold everything in it. The Irish Land Commission took the land, and they put it up for sale. But here's the point. That castle, with everything that was in it, and all those magical corridors and old libraries and bedrooms and stables and kitchens and sculleries and underground passages, that was my childhood playground.
Oh, my goodness. A playground for you.
Woo. You have no idea how magical it was. It informs me every day.
Oh.
I think about it every day. I go back there in my mind every day. I am the luckiest child you will ever meet in your life. It was absolutely marvelous. So I grew up in this farming country, dairy farms. For my summer vacation, I worked for farmers, helping with hay, running errands, learning to milk cows, doing all sorts of chores for maybe, you know, the equivalent in today's sense of day's terms of 50 cents a day. But it was terrific because I learned so much. I was mixing with safe adults and learning all kinds of things about the countryside, about the weather, about why birds fly upside down, as one man said to me, and it still comes into my work. And the things I heard and the sayings I heard, the odd things, the odd phrases, they're still with me. So it was the kind of richness of upbringing you could not imagine. Now, add into that from the side a voracious appetite for reading.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have a natural upbringing for a writer.
I think you should do a children's book with the title, "And the Luckiest Child You Will Ever Meet." Wouldn't that be fun?
Funny you should say that. At the moment, I'm publishing by myself, self-publishing, a series of long short stories on the internet, on Amazon, which you can do. Some of them I put up for free. Some of them cost $1.99. The first one, The Druid. The second, The Girl Who Lived in the Moon. The third is going up this weekend, called Pig Song.
Oh.
And the odd thing is that they're kind of emerging as stories for children as well as adults. They're based entirely on the style of storytelling that an old Irish wandering storyteller, a Shanachie, would use. This kind of overblown, colourful narration, and yet very economically spoken, but fantastical stories. The Girl Who Lives in the Moon, Girl Who Lived in the Moon, came to Earth, Donna Moonbeam, and influenced a whole lot of early Irish families and taught them how to see, how to hear, and how to speak. The Druid is an old matchmaker going way back before the time of St. Patrick. The current one, Pig Song, is about a certain Irishman, a very famous Irishman, who learned in circumstances of dire poverty how pigs could actually sing if you listened closely enough. So there's kind of crossover going on between childhood and adulthood for the reader, because it's in the writer. And I now understand that it's because that, in many ways, was the kind of crossover I had in my own life.
Oh, I'm so glad I asked you about this. I had
no
idea.
It's terrific. It's a great question.
So we can find these on Amazon?
They're on Amazon, on the internet.
Oh, wonderful. The other thing I love about you, and it's one of the things that I've always wanted to do, you gather everything, don't you? Everything that's coming, all the reading that you've done, the writing that you do, you keep track of everything.
Absolutely.
And it's just, it's a whole wealth of information you can use for documentaries and for books, because you're inquisitive. You're an inquisitive man.
Eternally, and compulsively inquisitive. If I met you on a train, I'd have your life story out of you in 5 minutes, because I would want to know it. And because there's genuine interest. There's nothing prurient about it. I really do want to know what makes people work. But here's the extraordinary thing, and this goes right into the belly of European thought as well. The great psychotherapist and thinker Carl Jung said that the conscious mind is like a tiny island floating on the vast sea of the unconscious, meaning that everything you take in goes into that unconscious mind. I will be working hard of a morning on a chapter of a book, and suddenly I find something would come up and pop out on the page that I can't have heard since I was 5 or 6 years old.
Goodness.
Some old recipe, something about a duck, something about the weather, something about how you know a storm is approaching. It can be absolutely anything. And I will look at it afterwards and say, where in the name of God did that come from? And then by the end of the day, I will know. That's also part of the advantage of never forgetting anything.
We welcome phone calls. Feel free to join our conversation. Frank Delaney is our guest this hour. It's hard to describe Frank. In addition to being incredibly eloquent, he has a phenomenal memory, and I love his inquisitiveness. He's done all kinds of novels about Ireland. He's been a wonderful broadcaster as well. He has done documentaries on Joyce Shaw, Wilde, Emily Dickinson, Robert Frost, Hemingway, Mailer, Matisse, Van Gogh, and many others. He has a documentary on the Celts, which was originally broadcast in 40 countries. It's still in DVD distribution. He lectures all over the world. He writes every day. He has this podcast series. We'll have to ask him about Joyce, although I still haven't read Ulysses. I'm embarrassed, but I said it to you, so I can say it to him. And we're celebrating St. Patrick's Day and all that that means this hour of the program. Here is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to have you with us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And we ask, of course, we can do this too if you want to. Once upon a time, he asks you to finish that, too, if you want to do that, or how you celebrate St. Patrick's Day, why it is that Ireland has this outsized reputation and that so many people who are not Irish at all embrace this particular holiday. And I hope it's more than, you know, green beer and going wild. To me, it, of course, is much more than that, and to a lot of people who celebrate it is. So Frank is our guest once a year. Today is the day. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frank Delaney is our guest celebrating St. Patrick's Day. His latest book, we should tell you, is The Last Storyteller. And he also informed us that he has this whole series of stories on Amazon. So you can look up some of the recent things that he's done that are for children and for adults as well, if you're looking for a short story to help celebrate the St. Patrick's Day holiday. We go to phone calls for Frank. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Scott in Wausau. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Hi.
This is great. Aaron brought up both of you. First, I'd love to say my mother's family is from Tipperary also.
Oh.
So, the one thing I see as being from Irish ancestry is this consistent ability to keep talking all the time. And, you know, and I also see a connection between superstition. So I always wondered if you know, these stories and somehow relate to what appears to be a huge affinity to superstition. I don't know why, or if that's just something I perceive, or if you think there's anything to that or not. I'm going to take my questions off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the call.
Superstition.
Yes, superstition.
Well, my explanation for it is, and I saw a lot of it as a child, huge amount of it. My deeply devout Catholic mother was profoundly superstitious. And the gap of time in Ireland, in a small community, where families, apart from emigration, pretty well stay in the same place. The first Delaney is mentioned in our part of the world in the year 464.
Oh, my.
And they're still there. The gap of time is very, very short. And Ireland was a pagan country for a long, long time. It might have been Christianized by St. Patrick, but it gave up its paganism very reluctantly. And, of course, Patrick didn't help, because what Patrick did was he said, okay, keep your gods and goddesses, only we call them saints if it's okay with you. And that's how he Christianized. A great way of doing it. But, for example, when I was growing up, if you found eggshells sown in your potato garden, you hit the roof with anger because it meant it was somebody had placed a curse there. That they're going to take away all your... The empty shells meant you would have no potatoes. Nothing round would grow. Nothing oval would grow in those drills. There were all kinds of superstitions about Easter water. You went to the church at Easter, you got a bottle of water blessed, and you scattered that among your crops so that they would grow. And it was to ward off evil spirits. So that paganism, I don't know if it's still there, but in the Irish countryside when I was growing up, it was absolutely rife. I asked my mother about it many, many times. I used to say to her, no, if you're a Catholic, how can you believe in this? It's nothing to do with Catholicism, she'd tell you, with complete logic. My mother's logic was really an amazing sort of an amazing variety. It was Irish logic. My mother was capable of believing two directly conflicting things with total equal passion. So that was this very, very devout country, this where there was 100% attendance at Mass in the rural parishes on a Sunday morning,
Oof.
Still embraced what we used to call pishogues, superstitions.
Hmm.
And they were very, very much alive when I grew up. And, of course, they weren't much good to us then, but I can tell you, if you want to write about it, they're great now.
And what about this idea? Maybe a lot of people like to talk. My husband always tells me that that women like to talk more than men, and he thinks he talks a lot, and I think he doesn't talk very much at all. So I don't know if it's an Irish thing or what. But when you look at the great talkers, many of whom you have written about and done documentaries about, the list is long of superb Irish talkers.
We were disempowered for a very long time by our nearest neighbor for 800 years. It was the best thing ever happened to us. We had 800 years of the most wonderful victimhood. If you want to see the way we turned it into poetry and success, then it was indeed wonderful. Talking is a matter of power.
Mm.
While you're talking, you have the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else can talk over you unless they're extremely rude. Mm-hmm. So the more you talk, the more power you have. Mm. That's my explanation for it.
Well, that's very interesting.
And therefore the Irish talk a lot because not accustomed to power once they got it. And of course it's also a means of obfuscation. You can blind anybody with talk. You can confuse anybody with glorious language. Ask any good courtroom attorney.
Yes.
Language is three-quarters of the battle. Get the words right and everything else will follow. And we talk a lot for a variety of reasons. And in the talk in Ireland, there's also something else going on. Because in talking to people, you're watching their reactions. And you learn more about people almost from what they don't say, but in their reactions, than from what they do say. We're intensely inquisitive people. We always want to know about other people. But principally, we want to know how much money they're earning in case they're better off than we are, or in the hope that they're better off than we are, because then we can feel victimized all over again.
Gary in Dubuque. Hi, Gary. You're with us, Gary. Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I would just like to say how entertaining your guest sounds, and that I grew up manufacturing castles in my mind, and I'm a 62-year-old child at heart, and I think that he should write some books all about running around in a castle and meeting leprechauns, and it's just magical to me. The hair stood up on the back of my neck. I don't have much else to say, but write some stories about castle.
Well, I can give you, Gary, a little interim gift. Are you on the internet?
No, I am not right this minute.
No, but the next time you're on the next time you're on,
I have access to the internet.
The next time you're on the internet, Google the images for a place called Thomastown Castle, Ireland.
Thomastown.
And that's the castle.
Okay.
And you'll be astounded at how beautiful it is.
Oh.
And as you see it there, as you see it on the screen in all its glory, is more or less how I knew it growing up. So that will give you some idea of the magical childhood I was able to invent for myself in the ruins of this wonderful place.
Mm. Thank you, Gary, so much for your call. Andy in Harper Ferry, Iowa. Hi. Hi,
Hello.
Andy.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How are you, Andy?
I'm fine.
Good.
I have a question. I always under the impression the Irish were the best storyteller. Did I understand your guest correctly when he said the best storytellers were Jews from Eastern Europe?
No, I didn't say they were the best. I would never say there was anyone better than an Irishman at telling stories. But I do know that the Jews from Eastern Europe are fabulous storytellers.
Uh-huh.
Because I've heard them.
Yeah. Well, the other question is, why did Ireland, the people that leave Ireland have such fond memories, and my ancestors, some are parents and some are grandparents, came from the Netherlands, and they left. They did not bring anything, at least they didn't talk about it ever.
From the Netherlands. The Netherlands, though, was a kind of more voluntary migration than the Irish had the chance to have. Most migration from Ireland was a matter of dire necessity, or sometimes expulsion. It's a little-known fact and a highly controversial fact, and I'm digging away at it at the moment because the documentation on it is very sparse and very hard to come by, that the first slaves in the United States, the first documentable slaves in the United States, were the Irish. They were shipped over
here by Irish landlords and by King James to get rid of them. He shipped, King James took 550,000 Irish people off the island of Ireland in the 1600s. And they became slaves on the plantations of the south and along the great Dutch plantations along the Hudson. So that was a forced migration long before the African Americans came in. That was a forced migration. Where people from Europe left, their economic needs were not as dire. The migration wasn't as forced. The Germans, for example, many of the German migrations, according to the documentation I've seen, were matters more of opportunity than of necessity. Whereas the Irish, even though there were dreams of opportunity, it was really largely necessity that drove them to the New World.
Are you writing a book? We talked about this last year, I think. Are you writing a book about the Irish slaves?
It'll take me years, Kathleen. It is so hard to find anything on.
Is it?
It's so hard to document. I know where there are two really interesting caches of information, but it's so hard to find anything. And a lot of the documentation is anecdotal. For example, the great landscape designer Frederick Olmsted,
mm-hmm.
he wrote a memoir of a journey to the south where he describes the Irish slaves on the plantations of the south and loading the cotton bales on the boats on the Mississippi mm-hmm. and describing them as the only form of life that was lower than the African American.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story that has been completely covered over.
Yes.
And I realize it's controversial because once you have owned, for example, the moral high ground of having come from slavery, you're not going to let anyone take that away from you. And the Irish have never tried to claim that high ground, probably because of shame.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep working on that.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Andy, thanks for your call. Ken in Oshkosh, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wondered if the gentleman would perhaps speak a little bit about Col Hain and the Dainai. How the High Kings came about, especially Beru. And from what I understand, even to this day, roads are redirected because of the little people. Wondered if he had some stories about that.
Oh, yes. I mean, all of those come into the realm of fact, even though it's fantasy. In school, we were taught as history this particular detail. The first division, the first political division of Ireland, came after the Second Great Battle of Moytura, when the Milesians from northern Spain defeated the people of the goddess Dana, or Danu, the Danu, as the gentleman has just said, as Ken has just said, and they agreed to divide Ireland between them. So the Milesians, the conquerors, took all of Ireland above the ground, and the people of Danu took all of Ireland below the ground, and they became the little people. And the places where they came to the surface were these fairy forts, these rings, which people would not excavate, because if you dug inside a fairy fort, you'd be found dead there at dawn. And there have been cases of roads rerouted. I saw it happen in my own childhood.
Really?
Happened a few years ago in County Galway, my son told me, where they went around a fairy fort rather than went through it. That's how strong the superstition is. Brian Boru is an O'Brien, one of the oldest names in Europe. Before Patrick came to Ireland in 432, came back as an evangelist, Ireland was governed by about 150 what they call petty, in the sense of petite, the French word small, kingships. They were basically the families, the O'Briens, the McCarthys, the McCormicks, the O'Donnells, the Murphys, the O'Reillys, the O'Boyles, and they were the rulers of the country. And the O'Briens were a very powerful clan down in the southwest on the coast of in the County Clare. To this day, everywhere you go in Limerick and Clare, there are O'Briens everywhere. You couldn't throw a stone without hitting an O'Brien in County Clare. Cuchulainn was the great warrior god. Some people call it Cuchulainn. Some people call it Culhane. Some people call it Cuchulainn. I grew up calling it Cuchulainn because the Gaelic I speak comes from the south of Ireland, which is a much broader mouth shape than the tight sort of Northern Irish accent where your mouth is much smaller when you're squeezing out the words. And down in the south, we have a much broader thing. So we don't call it Cuchulainn. We call it Cuchulainn. And he was a great warrior god from the old fantasies because the Fenian cycle literature in Ireland is one of the finest bodies of mythology in the world, and it began as stories told by firesides.
Thank you, Ken. Dick in Waukesha, hi.
Yes, I have a question about a name. My late wife was an M-U-R-N-A-N.
Murnan.
And, they pronounced it, and we pronounce it Murnan.
That's right.
We've been hearing And another question is about Murnane. We've been hearing from people around here that it's Murnan. We heard it over the years, and we'd always corrected them. Which is the correct pronunciation of Murnan?
It comes originally from the name Murnahan, Murnaghan. And the correct pronunciation of a name that is spelled Marnane or Murnane is Murnan or Murnane. Murnan we say in Tipperary, and it's a strong Tipperary name. There are a lot of Murnans around Tipperary town. In fact, one of the best historians in the county, or indeed in the south of Ireland, is a man called Des Murnan.
Hmm.
And we would always refer to that name, whether it's spelled M-U-R or M-A-R, as Murnan. But in other parts of the country, they'd call it Murnane, but Murnane is generally thought to be an American pronunciation. So stick with Murnan, and you'll be fine.
There you go, Dick.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Ray is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. I want to touch on something your guest just brought up about Irish being labeled as the lowest human life form. Could he expand on that, since it was Charles Darwin who really put that into the forefront in his original manuscripts from The Theory of Evolution? He compares the Irish and says, you know, they're the lowest life form of the humans. And I actually got this information from public radio, and another teacher who was Teacher of the Year from New York City, his name is John Taylor Gatto, and he put out a five-hour lecture series, which just explodes all of this stuff in this country. And he touches on the Irish, too. And just does the guest know about Darwin's true disdain for the Irish, and that it was in his original manuscript on the theory of evolution?
I've heard it disputed, and I'm inclined to believe those who dispute it, because Darwin was, above everything else in the world, an enormously benevolent man. I'm actually writing about him at the moment.
Oh, you are?
I'm writing a novel in which Darwin appears as a character.
Oh.
He was an enormously benevolent man. I have to say I did not know his view of the Irish, but I will look it up. But here's my own take on that, and it's shaped by a lot of other information. You have to bear in mind that whenever we do somebody a bad turn, we tend to speak very badly of them. When we were so victimized and so dispossessed and so thrown off our land by the English, they gave us a bad press the world over.
Hmm.
And since they owned much of the world at that stage, and since they still had a large stake in the United States, when the Irish began coming over to the United States, they were branded ever before they got here. They arrived immensely dispossessed. They arrived in these coffin ships. Half the cargo died on the way or thrown overboard. They took the lowest jobs they could find because they had to get some kind of foothold. They were fighting on that low level with the African Americans for whatever was going in the marketplace. And they were treated. If you look at the Punch cartoons, the English language, English publication Punch cartoons of the Irish in America in the 1800s, they depict a man dressed in ragged old tweeds with an appalling hat, carrying a shillelagh, and looking more or less like an ape. That's the kind of propaganda that was turned against the Irish, and it intensified after 1920 for a period, because the Irish were the first nation on earth to put a serious dent, after the Revolutionary War in America, to put a serious dent in the remaining British Empire. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the empire began to come apart after the Irish Treaty of 1921. Slowly but surely, the empire began to dismantle itself. India went to 1948, and so on and so forth. So we were labeled from the very beginning by our conquerors, because what can you do to justify what you've done to these people except say that they are more or less subhuman? It's exactly what Hitler did with the Jews in Germany.
Interesting response. Frank Delaney is our guest as we celebrate an early St. Patrick's Day, the most eloquent man in the world who knows so much, as you can tell, about so much. His latest book is The Last Storyteller. He also has some stories, which you can find on Amazon.com. I highly recommend his website because he's got things going on all the time. He's got contests, who can answer best the question, once upon a time, da-da-da-da-da-da, finish that. It's what he's reading. It's information about the lectures that he gives and the documentaries that he's made. It's a highly entertaining site, frankdelaney.com. Oh, and I almost forgot the line-by-line examination of Ulysses, which we'll ask him about a little bit later. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. James Galway and the Chieftains. It's always been, maybe because I had an uncle, Uncle Dan O'Leary, conductor on the Chicago Northwestern, who used to make everybody sing Irish songs every day as they went into the city. I love that song. Frank Delaney is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Last Storyteller. I think last year you did the poem for me. I have an Irish dinner every year, and I make people read poetry. And this year I've done The Lake Isle of Innisfree, Frank, for a good 20 years. I need something new this year. Have you got a
poem? Lake Isle of Innisfree is a medium. Like, here's a good Yeats poem you might try.
Okay.
Called The Hosts of the Air.
Okay.
It's somewhat longer. Do you know? It's kind of mythological, and there's a kind of magic at the core of it.
Are you going to read it for me?
I will find a copy right now, but I can start while I'm looking for it on my bookshelves. I will start you off with it. And it begins, O'Driscoll drove with a song, the wild duck and the drake, from the tall and the tufted reeds of the drear heart lake. And he saw how the reeds grew dark with the coming of night tide, and he dreamed of the long dim hair of Bridget his bride. And he heard as he sang and he dreamed a piper piping away, and never was piping so sad, and never was piping so gay. And some sonso has taken my Yeats from my bookshelves.
Oh, for heaven's sake. That's okay. I loved what you gave us. I will read that. I will look it up.
Have a look at it. It's called The Hosts of the Air, and it's very haunting. Mm. And if you read it slowly, you'll find the audience gets kind of mesmerized because they got caught up in the story. It's a story of a young man playing a game of cards with elderly men. And while he's playing this game of cards, another young man comes and whisks away Bridget, his bride. And the other young man may be from the fairy folk, may be a ghost from the other world, may be a strange and exotic dancer who's going to steal her. And it's all in the dream of this man as he's walking by the reeds in the lakeside in the evening.
Mm. Lovely. Tim in Port Washington. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Hey, Frank. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Tim.
Absolutely amazing. Just love all your work and what you're talking about. I'd like to have you comment on the band U2 and Bono and all the great work he's done for the world. I'll take my call, answer off the air.
Thanks, Tim.
It's extraordinary what U2 has done. It's monumental. They had this phenomenal success with the young people of the world through their music. They came out of Dublin and only out of Dublin. They were Irish to the core. And from that position, once they had made their money, they looked around and they thought, look what we have come from. And look what we can now do with the money we have. And in the greatest spirit of generosity, and with the largest heart and the most gleaming souls, they set to work in a very simple way, trying to influence people to wage what I believe as a militant pacifist, what I believe is the only war we should be fighting anywhere on Earth, which is the war against poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And that fundamentally is what you do and what Bono did. So they took the spirit of this music, which people so loved, and they kind of converted it into social and emotional coinage. And they spent that money all over the world on the idea that nobody should be poor or hungry or homeless. It's a fabulous, fabulous accomplishment, and in some ways they've only begun.
Hmm. Wonderful answer. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. This is sort of one of those mushy questions. It's about Samuel Beckett, who I think is Irish in background. I know he went to, I think, Trinity College, but he wrote most of his life, and also one of the most important writers in the modern age. He lived most of his life in France.
That's right.
And I do know that they were not Roman Catholic, but I think his family came out of the Church of Ireland, and I'm right now, as a matter of fact, looking at an early poem he published, four lines, that seems to me to capture the essence of a kind of a spirit of the Irish diaspora. But he did spend the years of learning, squandering courage for the years of wandering through a world politely turning from the loutishness of learning. And I'm wondering if your guest can talk a little bit about the power of of the expatriation spirit of the Irish. That is, when you, and it's true, it's among the Jews too, these forced migrations, and how in America and elsewhere the Irish have really been sort of literary giants.
Hmm.
There's a desire to succeed once you leave your own country that is overwhelming, and there's a desire to tell the story of what you have come from and tell your own story.
Hmm.
We were talking earlier about telling one's own story. It's an overwhelming desire. It's very powerful. It's funny you should mention Beckett. I've been reading, the last few years, I've been reading more of Beckett than I've ever read before. And I'm slowly coming to the conclusion that he may finally, when all the bills are settled in about 200 years' time, he may turn out to have been the greatest of them all. He does indeed come from Dublin. He comes from the Protestant Anglo-Irish ruling caste tradition. But you see, the wonderful thing about the Anglo-Irish was that you had there the most imaginative of the Irish married into the most educated of the English. So the two fused. They fused in Oscar Wilde. They fused in George Bernard Shaw. They fused in Beckett. Beckett had a wonderful education, as you say correctly. He lived in Paris for a long time. But he couldn't escape, any more than Yeats could, he couldn't escape the kind of magical imagination that he encountered in Ireland, where people will tell you anything just for the sake of hearing the words come out of their mouth. And that's what Beckett got. And Beckett understood that and understood that he was getting it. And he used it from a very early age as part of his own life to inform himself and keep himself as sane as he could manage, which wasn't great eventually. He was a man prone to huge depressions. He then, when he took that to France, many people believed that French was his first language. And in actual fact, I think his great play, Waiting for Godot, was in fact first performed in French and then translated into English. Which brings me to your very good point about why the Irish so excel when they go abroad. We leave with all this gorgeous stuff inside us, except that we may not necessarily know at the time that it is gorgeous stuff. And there's the old saying, distance lends enchantment to the view. So everything you look back on is a lot more romantic, if you like, than it was when we lived there.
Yes, yes.
Where you were discouraged from being as expressive as that. Now, it's an export. You have with you an export material. You have a product, and you're going to sell that product to the world because that is actually who you are. And however Beckett tried to deal with that, his entire wellspring of material, the fountain he drew on, came from far beneath Irish soil. It's totally 100% Irish.
Hmm.
That's what he was.
Hmm. Oh, lovely answer. How's Joyce coming along? How's Ulysses coming along?
Well, isn't it the maddest thing you ever heard?
Yes, it is, Frank.
Isn't it crazy?
Yes, it is crazy.
This is what happened. Many years ago, my first book ever, Kathleen, was a book for all the people who had tried to read Ulysses and never managed to finish it. That's a lot of people.
It's me.
Yes. And it was me at the time. And then I read it, and I so loved it.
Aww.
I couldn't bear not to share it. And some years ago, when I started doing what modern authors have to do, which
we have about 20 seconds, just
truly marketing myself, I decided, what can I put up every day, what I can put up every week on my website that people will enjoy? And I thought, let me do something I've always wanted to do. Let me interrogate Ulysses so that by the time I have finished, which will be in 26 years, there
Frank.
Won't be a single reference in Ulysses ever obscure to anybody ever again. And that's what I'm doing. And I am having the time of my life.
Good for you. You're having the time of life always. Frank, thank you so much
pleasure,
for being with us.
As
thank
ever.
You. Our great pleasure to have you. FrankDelaney.com is how you get a hold of Frank. Go there. It's a great website. It's just a lot of fun. And a very happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you. I'll be with you again on Monday. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning.